you know, by most of those, that landing especially.
Senator Baca, quorum is now checked in. Welcome to the committee. We have Senate file 2663, and I believe you have an author's amendment with it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is the first committee, and there's an author's amendment, I believe, was probably suggested by counsel, just kind of get it in shape.
Senator Herr moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the author's shape. Is there any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This bill was brought to me by a constituent who is 100% disabled and and eligible for free hunting and fishing licenses and other DNR licenses, but finds it a quite an inconvenience to have to periodically go and get re-examined by a doctor, get new papers, and then have to bring them to the issuing station to then qualify for free licenses again. So what the request is to just the fact that they're 100% disabled, nobody's denying that, is just give them the convenience of putting that designation on the back of the driver's license like other designations that are there so that they don't have to go through that paperwork process over and over. That's the extent of it. I've talked with Senator Dibble about it. He certainly has to see the bill also. And the department is here. And you'll notice there's a fiscal note attached to it. We'll work with the department on that. Out of the Game and Fish Fund, and that is because when they reprogram the ELS system, there's some cost involved in that. That's done periodically. I think that the department's fiscal note, I think the cost of this specific provision is probably going to be shared with other provisions that are going to be changed at the time they do the ELS update. So you can see we don't actually make this effective even until 2016, so we don't have to go through a special update of the ELS system. So, but there'll be other changes made at the same time. So even though this shows as the cost of updating the ELS system, there'll be a number of other changes made when they do that update.
Okay. Mr. Meyer, did you just want to say anything or just for questions?
Mr. Chairman, members, just really quickly, we are working with Senator Bach and also the House on this issue and Department of Public Safety to integrate this in. You'll see the effective date is January 1st, 2016, or the date the new driver and vehicle services information technology system is implemented. So it actually might be kicked out a little bit farther from there. But we're trying to figure out the most cost-effective way to do this. And also, perhaps between now and then, there might be another alternative to do the same thing that would be much more cheaper. So we're working with the author and the stakeholders involved to support the issue.
Okay, thank you. Is there any discussion from members of the committee? Is there anyone in the audience with concerns about the bill that wants to speak to it? If not, Senator Herr moves Senate file 2663 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to take up Senator Scoy's bill next because I believe he has to... He has another committee has to be at. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I have an author's amendment to A2. This is the first stop for Senate file 1971. So if somebody could move the A2 amendment.
Is that been distributed? It's being distributed. Senator Coonan will move that as soon as it's distributed. It's an author's amendment. It's being handed out right now. Is there any discussion on that? Not on Senator Coonan's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and that is a delete everything amendment that we've been working with Bowser and DNR on. Now, the reason that I'm here today is to put the bill in the shape that we think it should be in for further discussion. What is happening in Minnesota, particularly northern and northeastern Minnesota, where so much of the land is wetland and so much of their pre-settlement wetland are there, is that as mitigation is to be proposed for projects, we are having mitigation proposed in counties such as Lake of the Woods. Lake of the Woods County currently has well over 80% of its pre-settlement wetlands existing. I believe over 80% of the county is currently a wetland. So to be coming into Lake of the Woods County and doing wetland mitigation for other parts of the state is not adding much value to the utility of wetlands in Minnesota. So we started out, I've been working with my House colleague, Representative Erickson, on this, and we started out trying to figure out if there was a way to put some restrictions on using prime ag land for mitigation. And what we have come up with, Mr. Chair and members, is we think that it would be of value for a group of stakeholders and the department to sit down through the summer and try to analyze areas that the state has already determined to be high priority areas, where if we were to do wetland mitigation in those areas would actually bring some value. Because taking 640 acres of farmland out of production in Lake of the Woods County and converting it into wetlands in a county that has such a large percentage of its land already wetland and has such a large percentage of its pre-settlement wetlands in place, we do not think is the best use of the mitigation program. Now, Mr. Chair and members, Bob Meyer from DNR and Sarah Stroman from Water Soil Resources would like to come up and talk to the committee about the amendment and some of their ideas and direction. See that there is a long list of testifiers that also would like to have a few words with regard to the initiative that we're moving forward today. And so I think we should turn it over to them and then see where the testimony goes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. We'll start with Ms. Stroman or Mr. Meyer. Who wants to start?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm just going to be really brief in my comments and then turn it over to Ms. Stroman. The DNR and the Board of Water and Soil Resources have been working on this important issue. Senator Scoy raises some relevant concerns that we're also concerned about. And to deal with that, we pulled together an interagency team dealing with the siting of wetland mitigation in northeast Minnesota. I believe you've all seen a copy of their report. After this work was completed, we pulled together a couple of stakeholder meetings, one here in St. Paul that some of you I know were at, a lot of our stakeholders were at, and then one also in northern Minnesota that a lot of members were at as well, a lot of the same people talking about this issue and how we can move forward. So we are interested in trying to look at how do we achieve the goals of the Wetland Conservation Act while maintaining or creating the high value, the best value wetland restorations within the state and areas of the state that we need them the most. So that was kind of the focus, and how can we get the best value, not in terms of monetary value, but for the wetlands, functioning wetlands, where we need habitat, where we need water quality. And I think the recommendations of the report and the work group do that for the mining mitigations or wetland mitigations occurring in northeast Minnesota. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Stroman from the Board of Water and Soil Resources to talk about some of those specific recommendations in the language, and we'll move forward from there.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Ms. Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Stroman. I'm the Acting Deputy Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And what I want to do is just walk through the recommendations of the interagency team that worked on this issue. I'm going to do that at a high level. I think the purpose here is not to do a deep dive into the issues, but just walk through them and really affirm the agency's commitment to continue to work on this issue with the stakeholders as we have been over the last few months. One other note before I walk into the specific recommendations is just to be clear that these recommendations are with respect only to compensatory mitigation for unavoidable wetland impacts. They do not address or affect existing requirements to avoid or minimize impacts. We're talking only about when those parts of the sequencing have been through and we know we need to mitigate. The other thing I will note is that these recommendations are at a conceptual level, so we'll be talking about concepts. The details of implementation have not yet been worked out by the interagency team, and so that is the process that we will embark on here over the summer with the stakeholders are figuring out some of these details. As Mr. Meyer noted, we have handed out the executive summary of the interagency team report. The members of that team are listed on there, so you have the recommendations there. There also is a summary sheet of the recommendations that we handed out, along with the implementation mechanisms that would be needed to implement those recommendations. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll walk through those recommendations just briefly here. The first one has to do with wetland mitigation search criteria, and the team recommends that we clarify and better coordinate the criteria used under state and federal regulatory programs to evaluate the acceptability of wetland mitigation proposals. Secondly, the team looked at alternative mitigation options in Northeast Minnesota, specifically developing an expanded suite of options aimed at maintaining and improving aquatic resources in those watersheds in northeastern Minnesota. These alternative options include expanding the eligibility criteria for preservation credit, restoration and or protection of riparian corridors and streams, stabilizing the hydrology of altered waterways, restoring peatland hydrology, and lastly, allowing for credit for completion of certain approved watershed plan implementation projects. The third category of recommendations had to do with the wetland replacement siting sequence. And specifically here, the team was recommending, consistent with the watershed-based replacement approach, but that they recommend adding a step into the sequencing that before mitigation go anywhere in the state, that we add a category that if there isn't something available within the watershed or within the bank service area, that it go to an area of the state that has been pre-designated as a high priority area. So, for example, there are parts of the state like the Prairie Pothole area where we're working very hard to restore wetlands in that area. We could potentially get kind of a win-win situation here by sending mitigation wetlands there where they are needed for habitat value. Another example might be sending wetlands to areas where they are needed for flood mitigation purposes. Another recommendation from the committee involved the site analysis and site review process. So the team recommended establishing an inventory of siting analyses and potential mitigation sites that have been evaluated. And the idea here is that once a site has been evaluated and maybe determined to not be a good site, that it be inventoried as such so that the next project proposer doesn't have to reevaluate the same site over and over again. The team also suggested establishment of a rapid response or early review interagency team so that as a project proposer is looking at a potential restoration site, the agencies can come in and advise the proposer about the suitability of that site, perhaps before they get in and make investment in acquiring the site. Lastly, the team looked at a couple of alternative mechanisms for providing compensatory mitigation. There are two of these. One is the establishment of a Northeast Regional Wetland Mitigation Cooperative, or an umbrella bank. So this would be a wetland bank that would specifically serve the mitigation needs in Northeast Minnesota. And the second option looked at was establishment of an in-lieu fee program. And so this would be a process by which permit applicants would pay a fee to an entity to operate an in-lieu fee program, which then it would be that third-party entity that would take on the obligation of the wetland mitigation rather than the project proposer. They would simply pay the fee for that restoration. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that is the high-level summary of the recommendations contained in the interagency team's report. I will just summarize specifically with respect to the amendment that Senator Skoy has offered. That amendment focuses particularly on three of those recommendations: the in-lieu fee program authority, which then would need to be further defined via rulemaking, the establishment of those priority areas in the siting sequencing, and then lastly was that early response rapid review team, the interagency team. So those were the three elements that were contained in the delete all amendment.
And Ms. Strumman, the replacement siting, the high priority areas, that's the one on top of page 5. That's what you'd be
Mr. Chairman, you're talking about the top of page 5 of the delete all amendment?
Yeah, that's the language that you're talking about for inserting in the priority risk?
That's correct. So that language would be inserted in the siting sequence. So it would still be restoration within the same watershed, within the same bank service area, then within a priority area, and then beyond that in another bank service area elsewhere in the state.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Senator Scalzi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Stroman, it's kind of hard for me to find out if there's something in here specifically that would require someone to actually create a wetland. And I'm aware of the farm in question because I grew up there and I knew the family that owned that farm. And that farm was your typical wonderful American family farm where a family was raised on that farm, and they were wonderful people, and I know them well. So it's a little troubling to me to find out that that particular farm was bought in a county where it's tough to find good farmland, as Senator Skoy mentioned, 80% of that county is wetland. So that was good farmland, and I'm wondering, in this delete all amendment, is there instructions that would require someone to actually create a wetland? In other words, not just buy a piece of property and then call it a wetland, or there's definition of wetland and it relates to the plants and the capacity and everything like that. Is there anything in here that would require that actual creation of a working wetland by definition?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scalzi, so those requirements exist already, the requirements for what constitutes the obligation of the wetland restoration, and there would be a restoration plan that would be approved by the agencies with jurisdiction over that particular proposal. So we're not proposing to change that. The issue here is that, as Senator Skoy said, because there are limited sites available in Northeast Minnesota, some of the sites that end up being chosen are sites that, frankly, don't lend themselves hydrologically to high-quality restorations. And so what we're trying to do is offer alternatives for folks to steer away from those sites that probably aren't going to yield high-quality restorations to areas where we will get higher value in terms of the wetland functions, the habitat value, those kinds of things.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scalzi, the proposal that is in this county is complying with the current rules and regulations with regard to wetland mitigation.
Yeah.
They are on the path toward utilizing that site, even though, in my opinion, it's not ideal. So what I'd like to think is going to happen in the future is that when there are mitigation proposals that come forward, after you've gone through the avoidance, minimize, and you get to the mitigation step, and then you go through the watershed to see if there are high priorities within the real local watershed that might need to be addressed. At some point, we would look outside, find these high-priority areas that have already been identified in a number of state plans, whether they're the Prairie Pothole Region or plans for flood mitigation. And I wouldn't be proposing that we would increase the cost for the mitigator, that we wouldn't try to increase the ratio these other proposals would be, but we would allow them to move forward if we'd end up with a more functional wetland in, that would be a higher priority for the state.
Right.
So I don't think we're going to be able to solve that nut today.
Mm-hmm.
But what the goal is, and I don't know if Ms. Stroman or Mr. Meyer want to address this, or maybe we want to talk about it when we get to the end of the committee meeting, the goal is that the department will be convening meetings this summer. I don't know if they're going to use some kind of full rulemaking process or what we're going to exactly do for a process, but we'll be getting the departments and the stakeholders into meetings and see if there's a mechanism actually achieve higher priority wetland mitigation for the state than what we currently are achieving. And this project has kind of highlighted that there's a need for taking a look at that, I believe. And so if Ms. Stroman, if you're Mr. Meyer, if either one of you want to just a brief comment of what you envision might be going on this summer with some guidance from the legislature, you know, formal or informal, I don't know if you're ready for that or not.
Thank you.
Buddy?
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't think we are ready to explain exactly what that process is at this point. We have met both individually with a number of the stakeholders. We've met as a group with a number of them. I'm sure there are probably other folks who are interested as well. And so I think that's one of the first next steps that we need to take is to find what that process will be. But I think certainly you know, the agencies are committed to moving this forward, and my understanding from another stakeholders, and I believe you'll hear from them today, is those folks are committed as well.
Okay. And maybe we should hear from those stakeholders now briefly. So why don't we start with, we have Mr. Bodzik, Mr. Arnasty, and Mr. Ness be the next three. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead in whichever order you'd like.
Ladies first. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jill Bathke, and I'm the natural resource scientist with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I have a bachelor's in science and environmental science and a graduate certificate in stream restoration science and engineering. There are three points on the topic of wetland replacement in northeast Minnesota that I'd like to address to the committee today. These topics include an overview of the importance of wetlands and the watershed approach, current practices of wetland replacement in northeast Minnesota, alternative mitigation options and procedures for northeast Minnesota. Before I get too much further into my testimony, I'd like to define a few terms that I'll be using today. First, a watershed. A watershed is an area of land that flows to a particular river, lake, or sea. For example, if a rain drops in the Mississippi River watershed, unless it goes to groundwater or is used by humans, plants, or animals, that raindrop will eventually go to the Mississippi River. Next, a wetland. A wetland is an area that is saturated with water for part of most years. Wetlands have unique vegetation and soils from other landscapes such as prairies and upland forests. The last term is wetland replacement or mitigation. When someone would like to destroy a wetland, they are required to first avoid that impact, then minimize it, and then mitigate. Under most circumstances, the person that would like to destroy a wetland is required by both federal and state law to replace that wetland somewhere else on the landscape. Replacement often takes the form of restoration of a wetland that has been drained. Sometimes the terms wetland replacement and wetland mitigation are used interchangeably. Replacing wetland functions and values within a watershed is vital to supporting healthy rivers, lakes, and the countless species that rely on them. Scientific research clearly demonstrates that wetlands are chemically, physically, and biologically connected to the lakes, streams, and rivers that Minnesota is known for. Wetlands store groundwater that provide water to rivers in times of drought. Wetlands also provide important habitat for breeding fish, migrating birds, and many different mammals. They act as sinks by retaining floodwaters, sediment, and contaminants and nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen that would otherwise negatively impact the function of downstream waterways. If a wetland is destroyed, all those functions and values I just mentioned are also destroyed. On a small scale, these losses of wetlands may not be noticeable. However, it's estimated that over 5,000 acres of wetlands would be destroyed by transportation and mining projects in northeast Minnesota over the next 20 years. This estimate does not include indirect wetland impacts, which could increase that acreage to well over 10,000 acres. The loss of thousands of acres of wetlands without replacing them within the impacted watershed could have significant effects on the health of our streams, rivers, lakes, and groundwater. Wetlands that had previously lessened the effects of floods, provided base flow to rivers to support healthy fish population, and that cleaned our contaminated water will no longer provide those services to the watershed. Because wetlands are no longer providing these vital ecosystem services, taxpayers and the government will have to pick up the cost to clean water, restore habitat, and mitigate the effects of floods. This is the reason why replacement of wetlands within the watershed is vital. This method of wetland replacement is often referred to as a watershed approach. So how does wetland mitigation work in northeast Minnesota? The vast majority of wetland destruction in northeastern Minnesota occurs as a result of mining and transportation projects. Much of the wetland replacement for large-scale mining-related wetland destruction does not take a watershed approach. In fact, many of the taconite mines located in the St. Louis River watershed, but wetland replacement occurs within the Mississippi River or Rainy River watersheds. Further, there has been limited local engagement in the review of replacement sites. Because the review of many mine-related wetland impacts falls to the DNR rather than the local technical evaluation panel, local review of replacement sites is more limited than other projects that do not require permits to mine. The lack of local review and early coordination with agency staff has resulted in some situations where potential wetland mitigation sites may not be the best fit for the watershed, and the wetland restoration is not as successful as it could be. There are ways in which wetland mitigation can improve. When a company is searching for appropriate wetland mitigation opportunities, the local, state, and federal agencies with the authority to review, comment, and improve wetland replacement should be consulted very early in the process. Early review of potential replacement sites allows the regulatory agencies to communicate any potential hurdles upfront, such as poor restoration potential or zoning issues. This benefits the mining company by reducing the investment of time and money spent on sites that do not comply with state and federal standards. Early coordination was also one of the recommendations of the interagency report that Sarah and Bob presented on earlier. The report identified wetland mitigation opportunities that may better fit the characteristics and needs of the St. Louis and Rainy River watersheds, the watersheds that make up northeastern Minnesota. Alternative mitigation options also included increased use of preservation of high-quality wetlands, streams and uplands, stream restoration, peatland restoration, and other watershed projects. All these ideas warrant further discussion and potential use as options for wetland mitigation in northeast Minnesota. Minnesota should take a cautious but active approach in the implementation of new alternative mitigation options for northeast Minnesota. That approach should look at conformity with the federal mitigation rule, ways to promote the avoidance and minimization of wetland impacts, adherence to a watershed approach, and ways in which the review and replacement of wetlands in the northeast can be improved. Further, some of these recommendations should only be adopted through the full rulemaking process. The interagency report is an important first step, one that should provide the framework for ongoing stakeholder dialogue. In conclusion, it's clear that wetland mitigation opportunities in northeast Minnesota must be approved, and the status quo is not working. However, with further guidance on the development of new opportunities for in-watershed mitigation, this situation can be improved. MCEA anticipates working with the agencies on the thoughtful consideration on how these recommendations can be implemented in a manner consistent with the watershed approach and protective of the unique and vital wetland habitats of the northeast corner of our state. Thank you for your attention, Mr. Chairman. That completes my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Bathke. And I'm sure all of you are going to be involved in this conversation. They're intensive conversations. Who wants to go next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. Just note, this is my 30th year appearing before the Environment Committee, so I just turned 39 last week. So. I'll make my comments brief. I want to thank Senator Scoy and Representative Erickson for bringing forward this issue. We do agree we shouldn't be taking farmland and creating wetlands, not when we have so many replacement opportunities and, again, in high priorities to restore wetlands. 30-some years ago, when we started talking about the no net loss of wetlands. It took 5 years, lots of debates, lots of stakeholder meetings. I'm glad to hear Senator Scoia say that he would allow stakeholders to have another meeting during the summer, during the interim, to discuss this and move forward on this issue. But we knew at some point that one day this would come, that the wetlands in the north would be wanted to be drained and filled, and where would the replacement take place? According to law, it goes in a different watershed, the ratio will go to 2-1. Some of our folks think it should be more than that, so just to let you know that. But back to the issue at hand, we're willing to work with the senator, work with the representatives throughout this issue, and I'll conclude my comments at that point.
Thank you. And Mr. Ness, I think the assumption is not a meeting, but a lot of meetings that those of you who are very engaged in will be meeting with the agencies and everyone. So, yes, thank you. Mr. Arnosti.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Arnosti. I represent 17,000 Audubon members across the state of Minnesota. Wetland protection is critical to our membership's interest in the natural environment, in birds, waters, biodiversity, and the values that we wish to pass along to our children and grandchildren. We've been involved in state wetlands issues since before we've had a State Wetland Conservation Act, and we too are very concerned, very aware of the inappropriate outcomes of our current regulatory system, where we have a situation such as happened in Roseau County that is actually probably conforms to the standards as written, but it's not the intent, I believe, of nearly everybody. So we recognize that there is a need to change the manner in which mitigation is occurring, particularly in the wetland-rich areas of our state. I think Senator Scoia laid out for us some very interesting ideas, and I don't say this lightly, Senator, but I agreed with everything you testified to. And in the idea that we really should look at what the high priority restoration needs of the local watershed are, and those can be identified ahead of time in local water plans and some natural resource plans and other things like that. I think we agree that those should be the first place that mitigation should occur. They may not be traditional wetland restoration, however. They may be watershed protection measures that are certainly part of the function of a wetland. And I think this is something that we need to work out. But if the local needs have been fulfilled, then it's appropriate to begin to move further away and begin to move into priority restoration efforts in other watersheds in other parts of the state. The concept is fairly easy to say here. The devil, as always, is in the details. And if you notice, the report that you were handed out was issued just a little over 2 weeks ago. It's a very good framework, but there has not been sufficient time to really put the details to work. I pledge on behalf of the Audubon Society, our membership, and my personal involvement, we will be actively involved in this. We will seek solutions, and I fully anticipate that next year, when the legislature convenes, you'll have a set of diverse stakeholders recommending a course of action of some specific legislative changes that may be necessary, as well as an explanation of administrative or other types of actions that will be taking place. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Arnosti. Mr. Botzek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Gary Botzek, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Federation, and I want to speak a little bit for the birds and the bees and the other flight and animals. But Minnesota, as mentioned, has 10.6 million acres of wetland, or about 19% of our state is still covered by wetlands. And that's sort of the half glass that's full. The other half of that glass says we're losing them faster than we can count. And just today, in fact, President Obama instructed his Environmental Protection Agency, just like he's doing with the Clean Air Act, to go to work on the Clean Water Act to strengthen that because of the waters of the U.S. You've been reading about the Supreme Court rulings on this over 2001, 2006, instructing the EPA to do stronger things as it relate to the waters of the U.S. Minnesota's lost over half of our pre-settlement wetlands. In the Great Lakes, it's over 66%. That's a poor, half-empty part of the glass. And I'm just like Arnosti here, I agree with everything that Senator Scoia said today, but we're happy to see that this process is being allowed to continue. If you see that report, that was an agency report. The shareholders were briefed on it sort of after the finality of it. So we're anxious to get in the room and help make this work. There's no question that the losses of wetland in Minnesota have been to the farm areas of southern Minnesota, west central. The Prairie Pothole region, of course, is right in there, too. That's the duck factory. At least it used to be the duck factory for not just Minnesota, but the entire migration flightway. That's changing due to climate change and other conditions. That whole pattern is moving to the west. The North and South Dakota have realized the benefits of that. Hunters are going to South Dakota, North Dakota to shoot duck, not in Minnesota. They're going to North and South Dakota, particularly South Dakota, for pheasants, and that's not good. We spend billions of dollars on hunting and fishing in Minnesota, and clean water is a very integral part of that. Just go back to the Lasard-Sams constitutional proposal that passed in 2008. The fact that clean water was added to the habitat, put that over the top. People, an MEP, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, polls issues on a regular basis, and water, right off the chart, clean water, wetlands, stormwater retention ponds are, you know, everybody's best friend, and cattails should be our next best friend, too. So we stand ready to work with Senator Scoy, the state agencies, on coming up with a plan. We agree that the Wetlands Conservation Act, and Arnosti and Ness and I and others worked on this in the 90s, was geared toward farming. And the mining proposals are a different animal, and they're big acres, though. We're talking 5,000 to 10,000 wetland acres impact. That's a lot to pick up and move to another watershed or another part of the state. And as we all know, and Mother Nature or God or somebody did a pretty good job with these wetlands. And for man to come in and bring a backhoe in and dig a hole in the ground and say it's going to fill up with water, that's not a very necessarily a good functional wetland. So we have to be a little careful, and thus the reason for the 2-to-1, 3-to-1 replacement ratios that are in current law. That needs to be considered as we move forward. And Mr. Chairman, we pledge to work on behalf of the outdoor community to make this work, and we'll work with Senator Scoy and others to make it happen.
Thank you. Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say the right kind of cattails in the right place can be our best friend.
Right. Okay.
That's good. Did him to put that narrow leaf in base.
Never heard that issue before. Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And just briefly, I want to say that my friendship with Mr. Arnosti goes back to late 80s, early 90s, probably in this very room. Debating wetland issues, so we've been around this a long time. Mm-hmm. We have developed a little trust in each other, so I think that'll be helpful. I do want to say that in order for the good things to occur with regard to wetland mitigation that has just been testified to, changes will have to occur, because what is being proposed is meeting the letter of the law today. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the spirit of the law, but it is meeting the letter of the law. And so we're all going to have to sit down and roll our arms and figure out how to do this so that we do have value wetland mitigation. And I also want to repeat that I am not proposing that we make significant changes into the current mitigation requirements of the mitigators, because they would be in pretty significant opposition to that. And just one other thing that came up in testimony that I think is really important for us to be contemplating is the county water plans that are in place across the state. They're really where people have done pretty significant work bringing their important local water issues to bear within their jurisdiction. So I know there's other people that testify, but I wanted to add that.
Okay, thank you. And we have three more, I hope, fairly brief testifiers on this. Mr. Peterson from Farmers Union, Mr. Pagel. And Ms. Garlitz, if you can be ready as soon as the first one of them is to move up to the table then. Welcome, Mr. Peterson. Go ahead.
Yep, Mr. Chair, members, my name's Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'll be very brief because we're just here to echo a lot of what Senator Skoy said and what you've heard. You know, when I travel, especially up into northeastern Minnesota, and I've heard from a lot of different farmers this concern about the replacement wetlands and the mitigation plans, you know, and they're trying to, you know, and you're in an 80% county. There is a lot of agriculture in those counties, believe it or not. Senator Skoy mentioned Lake of the Woods or Aiken County is another county I'm familiar with the issue in this issue. And it's hard for those farmers when, again, they're competing against a larger mitigation replacement plan to farm and keep their land. And so I appreciate Senator Skoy, Representative Erickson's work, and we look forward to working with the DNR and Board of Water and Soil Resources on this, issue as it goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pagel.
Hi, my name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair and Senators. I'm going to be very brief in stating that we've been working on this for quite some time. We have had the Northeast Minnesota wetland mitigation, and we've actually, several years ago, got money to look at what wetlands are available. And we are finding that in Northeastern Minnesota, there's very few dry places to go where you won't have an impact somehow. And yes, mining is quite large. As we look at the rest of the state in the United States wanting to be self-sufficient, Minnesota is actually quite lucky. 80% of the first pour steel comes out of the iron of northeastern Minnesota. So the whole United States first pour steel comes out of northeastern Minnesota. And the recycling rate is about 92% for iron and steel. So basing it on that, we are trying to follow all the rules. Some of the bill that's been proposed, we only have an objection on one part. We look forward to working with the senator and others, with Bowser and DNR. But I think there's some information that we need to put forth that might be a little bit helpful. There's a concern about a one-to-one mitigation ratio, that there's a thought that we're able to skip around very easily. And I would like to introduce Peter Larson, who can give a little more background of what we really have to do before we can cite. We'll be very brief. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Larson, welcome. Please be brief as we say. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. We're here on behalf of U.S. Steel and just to talk to you a little bit about the mining industry's perspective. We have participated in the activities that have taken place over the last year on these Northeast mitigation issues and much longer than that, actually. And we just wanted to make a couple notes. One is just to make sure folks understand how hard we work on wetlands permitting issues. Just as an example, the Keetac expansion project that we were doing an EIS on a few years ago, just in order to figure out where to put our stockpiles, we twice went through a complete analysis of our entire site, worked through where the stockpiles could go, had a pause in our process that took 3 months because people weren't satisfied that we'd done enough to make sure we were avoiding and minimizing impacts. And I know that's not what this bill is about, but it is a critical path issue for a lot of expansions on how we actually get from a proposal to approval and mining. And we want to make sure we do that right. Our concern in this might be encapsulated this way. We do a lot of work to get to the point where we find that we have unavoidable impacts. We go out and find willing property owners to work with us. That's just where the system drives us. And we understand sometimes local neighbors and local government folks might not like the choice that property owner made, but that's just the process that we go through. And we understand that that might not be as satisfactory as it might be to some. Our concern is that we have a very complicated system that drives us to the mitigation sites that we get to now. We'd like to make sure that that system isn't thrown out in hopes that an alternative system works better. We'd like to know that the system that we're working through now will continue to be available, and if there's a preferred option, we'd like to have it be actually something that is preferred for everybody, that allows folks to not lose a lot of time, lose a lot of money in projects that, in general, people want to have proceed. So we're happy to hear the comments that this isn't intended to make this process longer or more expensive, but these projects are so complicated, it's hard for us to understand how alternatives could be inserted and current options foreclosed immediately without some idea of how those alternatives are going to actually work in detail.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. I'm going to give a final word on this to Ms. Gartlett and the counties.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalee Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'd like to thank Senator Scully and the agencies for working on this issue. As the bill author discussed, the need for flexibility and the issue surrounding wetlands is a very important topic for counties around the state. We're very interested in finding more flexibility in how to work, how counties work with wetlands. As Senator Scully, as he mentioned, counties already have identified a lot of wetland mitigation, a lot of restoration opportunities that are in our water plans, our county water plans. And as we move forward on one watershed, one plan development, I think that we'll have even more ideas on how watershed districts, SWCDs, and counties can work together and where these opportunities for high-priority restoration projects lie. Counties are interested in enhancing mitigation projects on a statewide basis by placing an emphasis on public value on projects rather than size. And we're also very interested and supportive of developing an in-lieu fee program, as it's mentioned in some of these. So we're very excited to continue discussions on this. We'll work with Senator Scully and others, state agencies, and all the interested parties over the interim to try to find some solutions and some suggestions to move forward on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the testifiers and those that appear to be committing to work on this through the summer. Mr. Chair, if you would be encouraging to the agencies to move forward on this, I would appreciate it. I think that as somebody who's been around this for a number of years, I know that these things can bog down in the controversial issues surrounding wetlands. I mean, there's a lot of them. You know, what counts, what doesn't count, what's the no net loss, ramifications, how do we go around valuing areas that should have 1-to-1 and 2-to-1 and all of this. But I think if we will focus in on the quality of the mitigation that's occurring, and if there's a mechanism that will improve that without making it exorbitantly more costly, we should be able to try to move forward. And so if we can get the agencies to hold a series of meetings, I would commit to attending as many as I can and try to be part of this dialogue, and with the expectation that maybe by next year at this time we'll be working on some legislative action in this committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. I know Representative Erickson's here as well, and I think the two of you, I'm sure you'll both be involved in those. And I think you pointed out that mitigation is being done is following the letter of the law, even if it's not the spirit of the law and what we want to have happen. So I think it's very appropriate, I want to second what you said, that we need Bowser and DNR to convene and to work out the details and figure out how to do this right. And I think all those folks who have testified are going to be at the table as well. But thanks to you and Representative Erickson for bringing it forward. And with that, you suggest we lay the bill on the table, and we'll do that and turn it over to the agencies and the stakeholders to work it out.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for the conversation today.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Jensen, we're going to take up Senate File 2797 next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment, an author's amendment, that would put the bill into the shape that I would like, if we could do that first.
Senator Coonan is the A2 amendment, is it?
A3.
Oops.
Should be an A3.
I'm sorry, I had the wrong one. An A3 amendment. It's in the packets. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, this is a bill to improve the state's emergency preparation and ability to respond to recent concerns over shipping crude oil through our state. Over the past decade, development in the oil fields of North Dakota have increased the amount of crude oil moving out of that region to refineries in the east and the south. pipelines carrying oil have been stretched to their limits, and railroads have been called on to transport increasing amounts of crude by rail. Since 2008, the number of tanker cars hauling crude oil have increased by 40-fold to an estimated 400,000 cars annually, and that trend will continue. Over the next decade, oil-based shipments are forecast to increase four times from the current 1 million barrels a day to more than 4.5 million barrels per day. While both railroads and pipelines have impressive safety records, recent incidents have increased the public awareness of what can happen should a spill or an accident occur. An explosion of tank cars near Castleton, North Dakota, in December focused public attention and produced a demand for better coordination of prevention and response by local, state, and federal government. The Federal Railroad Administration recently announced an agreement with the Association of American Railroads that will institute a number of voluntary operating practices for moving crude by rail, including increased track inspections, increased trackside technology, lowered operating speeds, increased first responder training, and development of an emergency response inventory along routes where crude is shipped. Senate File 2797 will complement all of those efforts. First, by increasing the training provided to first responders in Minnesota, coordinating public and private emergency response activities among railroads and pipelines, requiring railroads and pipelines to have an adequate equipment and personnel ready to respond in an emergency, and having railroads and pipeline companies file their response plans with the Pollution Control Agency. In addition, the MPCA will carry out a number of activities that will help local emergency managers and firefighters better understand the types of substances they are dealing with. The agency will also help develop mutual aid arrangements between public and private responders and participate in practice drills and related training sessions. Mr. Chairman, I want you to know that the railroads in particular have helped in developing this legislation. I believe it'll go a long way toward improving the public and private preparation for and ability to respond in a critical incident should it occur. I ask for your support.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Before we have your witnesses, I believe Ms. Fontaine has a technical amendment to the amendment we just drafted. Could you state that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On the A3 amendment on line 1.9, it should read page 3, line 32, delete spill or discharge incident, comma, or drill, and insert discharge. And this would make it consistent with the other body, the way that it is now in the other body, and I'm not sure why I had this amendment language, but this should make it read the same way.
Okay. Senator Herr moves the technical amendment to the A3 amendments. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Jensen, you want to start? Do you have the list of witnesses, or just go down the ones? We have Mr. Quigley first, and
that's fine.
You okay, we'll just go down the list.
Yep.
And Brian Sweeney is next. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. I am Philip Qualley, State Director for the United Transportation Union, representing the safety interests of 1,400 railroad conductors, switch foremen, yard masters, and remote control locomotive engineers in Minnesota. At the outset, I would like to state clearly that oil and other hazmat materials have been moved safely on the railroad for many decades. Oil is being moved safely by our crews at this moment, and we will continue moving oil years from now. However, incidents of derailment and collision do occur, and we must be prepared. UTU strongly supports the intent of this legislation to protect public safety. We welcome our state's interest in this safety area that has been in our charge, has been one of our grave concerns for many decades. Today, I'd like to briefly explain our railroad authority very quickly, as well as positive events at the federal level that are occurring now. A quick overview at the federal level, UTU supports the retirement and retrofitting of DOT 111 tank cars. We are also encouraged by BNSF's announcement that they will purchase 5,000 DOT 1232 tank cars. However, even with the retrofitting and replacement of cars, this is going to take years. And this will leave tens of thousands of DOT 111 single shell tank cars out moving hazardous material on our right-of-ways. UTU strongly supports the increased mechanical inspections of trains and increased track inspections, particularly those with inspections immediately ahead of unit hazmat trains. We also want to point out that in the area of track side detectors for dragging equipment, hot journals, this area of track appurtenance, which is a safety appliance, we must keep in mind are not federally regulated. And we have had concerns with their accuracy as well as management directives after defects have been found in trains this past winter. We also would like to cite that within our industry, management must continue to work to improve fatigue issues for train crews with accurate, realistic, and actively managed train lineups. UTU strongly supports a federal order or regulation requiring a five-car buffer between the first loaded hazmat car on a unit train and an occupied locomotive. Finally, we would also like to note that the Rail Safety Improvement Act of 2008 and the mandate for every occupied locomotive cab to have portable inhalation respirators, we still do not have that safety equipment due to delays in rulemaking. And finally, from the federal level, UTU wants to cite the importance of the passage of federal legislation 3040, House File 3040, the Safe Freight Act, which will mandate two-person train crews. With a certified conductor and engineer, train securement can be executed, crew resource management continues at the current procedural levels, and public safety is assured. So having said that, and looking at the state legislation, we really support the state moving forward here. We hope that, particularly looking at Section 4 in Senate File 2797, response preparedness, while we are not requesting any amendment today, we hope that rail labor will be included in any planning and advisory process. The reason being is that it's first responder safety. When a train derailment occurs, it is the conductor who will have, the, by federal regulation, the most current and updated train list with a hazardous material information. When a train derailment occurs, it is our charge to get that list to the first responders and advise evacuation. We have seen where trains are moving in route with hazardous material in train, where the railroad company's data centers have not updated the computers with the most recent status of the train's consist. So again, it's very important that when a derailment occurs, that we deliver our train's paperwork to the first responder and advise evacuation. That really is all about the safety of the first responder. That said, we hope that we will be included going forward in the discussions if the state should move this legislation. So this past week, I had the opportunity to sit in on some meetings where I heard the mayor of Wayzata expressing his concern about movement of hazardous materials and what they would do with, you know, if there was a spill, and how do they have booms in place for Lake Minnetonka. I can tell you that our train crews run trains around the clock down the Minnesota River Valley, immediately next to that river, as well as the Mississippi River and other rivers and in their watersheds. So in closing, I simply want to say that while we want to guard against needless alarmism, I do, and the railroad workers strongly support and respectfully submit that the legislature move with urgency and act this year to protect public safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Is there questions? If not, we'll continue with testimony. Mr. Sweeney, followed by Dave Brown, not to be confused with our committee member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. Wanted to first thank Senator Jensen for taking the time to meet with us and consider some changes to the bill that make it more workable, and we appreciate that effort as we go through this process. I wanted to just briefly echo some of the comments that she had mentioned earlier, that overall we do have a very good safety record with hauling hazardous materials. We've been at it for quite some time. We take it seriously. We do have systems in place to respond, both in terms of emergency response as well as environmental response. We have equipment. We have people located at various points across our system, including the Twin Cities. We also have a network of contractors that we call on. And we do provide a lot of training to local emergency responders to deal with these types of accidents, to work with them on how to set up the coordination, know what they're dealing with, how to respond in general to these situations and some of the specifics that go with dealing with releases and accidents with railroads. We have a number of measures in place. I won't go into detail, but since the accident in Canada last year, the rail industry did adopt different operating practices for this commodity. For this oil, it's handled, trains are handled differently than others. They're considered key trains, where they get the best handling. They have certain thresholds for speeds. Their speeds are lower than a general train would generally operate at. The wayside detectors that have been mentioned, the thresholds are different for those, so that there is more sensitivity paid, given to these trains, so that we have a better, safer handling. Standards have been up since last year with track inspections and so on. In the agreement with the Department of Transportation, we had already been exceeding the basic requirements of the Federal Railroad Administration for track inspections. And we also, as was mentioned, with the tank cars themselves that this travels in, we don't own the tank cars. Those are owned by either the shippers themselves or leasing companies. The federal rules currently are such that those tank cars are qualified to haul this commodity. We have been pushing for 3 years now to have the federal standard and rule change to require a stronger tank car. Roughly 60% of the oil coming out of the Bakken on BNSF travels in the newer, stronger cars. We'd like to see the federal government act as well to phase out the older cars and go with the new standard. The cars that BNSF is talking about hiring, we've put out a request for proposals for 5,000 tank cars that would be built even beyond the standards of the newer 1232 cars. They would have thicker shells. They would have double or full head shields on each end, protected valve configurations, thermal blankets to protect them more in the case of a fire and so on. So we do take it seriously. We are moving forward, and we do appreciate the opportunity to provide some input on this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Senator Sieben, then Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to Senator Jensen. Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing the legislation forward. This is a real concern of mine, as I have a lot of railroads that run through right through the middle of my district, and homes that are right next to the long trains with more and more oil that are passing by every day. I worked on legislation last year that I just want to bring to your attention. With Mr. Qualley and the railroads, that says that if there is an incident or a spill, the duty officer must be contacted, as well as the local police or fire, 911 in most cases, need to be contacted by the railroad immediately after the incident occurred. And the rationale for that was that the local responders, if there's a spill or something, and this is, we were talking about minor things too, not necessarily major catastrophic things, it's really important that the local responders know about that. And often what I recall is that the duty officer may be called, but then that wasn't necessarily being transmitted to the local first responders. So I noticed there's some language in the legislation where now it would be the Pollution Control Agency is being notified if there's a spill or accident, and I think that that's fine. I just want to ensure that that the state duty officer is still being notified, because I think the Department of Public Safety obviously still has a really important role to play if there are any accidents. And then we seem to work out a good way for the local units of government to be notified as well. So just some, you don't have to respond. It's just something to keep in mind as this keeps moving forward.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, the reason for this legislation is to make sure that that type of procedure is in place, and that is included in this. We've indicated that there would be a local incident commander, and that was not in legislation previously. The idea is that there are three commissioners that are responsible for these things. So you've got the Commissioner of Ag, Pollution Control, and Public Safety. And we use words in here like rapidly and thoroughly. Well, what does that mean? How are we going to inspect what we expect from this type of liability that happens when a hazardous material is done or happens? So absolutely, the coordination between the railroads, the state, and all of the departments that are responsible for making sure that we do what we need to clean up and take care of what has happened absolutely has to include people at the local level.
Thank you.
So we've got a long list of people. Senators Scalzi, Weber, Huffman, and Dibble is the order I've seen. So
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. And like Senator Sieben, I have a lot of railroads in my district. In fact, we have one large switching area, Cardigan Junction, which is right next to the water supply intake for the St. Paul water system, Vadnais Lake. So when we talk about sensitive areas, there's lots of areas that are considered sensitive, not maybe environmentally, but for a drinking water supply, it's very important. But my question was for Mr. Sweeney. I noted that you said that you're hoping that the federal government changes its legislation or rules to require the double wall cars. Can't the railroads do that without federal changes? And are there railroads that you're aware of that are moving toward the double walls and some that are not? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. As a common carrier under federal law, we're required to take the shipment if it's in an approved car. And so that limits our ability to say you have to put it in this certain type of car that, you know, even though what you have been using is okay. There are efforts being made within the industry to try and induce them, whether it be with rates or whatever, to go with the newer cars. And frankly, a lot of the shippers have been moving to the newer cars on their own. As leases are coming up, as they're expiring, the shippers are looking for the newer cars quite often to replace those.
Senator Weber, and then Senator Dibble now, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for Mr. Sweeney. Currently, do you provide a listing of materials you carry to local emergency personnel? And if a local fire department, for example, said we don't quite understand what we're dealing with this particular shipment, do you have resources that you make available to them now to help them understand and give advice on training?
Mr. Chair, Senator, when it comes to the information that's provided, what we provide on request to local emergency responders and agencies and the state is like the past year's listing for planning purposes. We have a couple of federal regulations that get in the way of providing any real-time information, both proprietary customer information, and then there are also Department of Homeland Security issues that get in the way of any real-time, plus just the practicality of providing notice to every emergency responder up and down the line on a shipment. Training, yes, we provide a lot of training to responders for how to deal with various the different types of equipment and so on. The information, yes, we have information provided. First information is in the train orders, which will give notice of what the commodity is and some special instructions there. We also have our environmental people and our operating control center in communication with the people on the site in situations such as this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say very quickly, in response to Senator Stevens' concern that was articulated about the protocol for emergencies, I did have a hand in crafting this bill, as well as two others, in conjunction with the state agencies, the Department of Public Safety and Department of Transportation, as well as the PCA. And so, and those bills are all been chopped up into three pieces so they can get through the bottleneck of this deadline week, and then they'll dovetail and come back together at the other end. And so no protocol is changed. So PCA, for example, isn't replacing what DPS would normally do. This is just clarifying PCA's functionality because, of course, they have the expertise around hazardous substances, so it's kind of weaving them into what already exists in terms of emergency response protocol. I had a couple of comments on Mr. Sweeney's both excellent questions from Senator Scalzi and Senator Weber. One is one thing to remember is railroads don't own the cars. I think that's the point that he was making. And so we do need federal action to make sure that these cars are more robust. And finally, this issue about notice along the line to the public safety agencies in real time, that's a real issue that's under hot discussion nationally. We'd like to, at least to be there to be some voluntary efforts so that public safety agencies can have some idea what's rolling through their communities on a real-time basis. Solving the security problems and the proprietary problems, there's something that stops the railroad companies from doing that, but you know, the valid concerns need to be addressed.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, and then we'll have some more witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who I should be asking this to, perhaps Senator Jensen. The changes on the amendment, does that get this bill more in line with the federal requirements?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the things on the amendment were through working relationship with interested parties to make sure that it's workable.
Okay. I'm sorry. I stepped out for a second. And Senator Jensen, this we do have an Office of Public or Pipeline Safety. Has that been – have they been in these discussions also along with the DPS and
– Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, they have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cawley and Mr. Sweeney. We have next Dave Brown and Aaron Roth. Mr. Brown, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Brown. I'm here representing today the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, a division of the Teamsters Rail Conference. We're an organization, a union that actually began in 1863 and still alive and well today. Mr. Chairman, committee members, for 150 years, the BLET has worked with the industries, the government, and other rail unions to make certain that railroads provide for the safety of our members, the public, and the environment. On behalf of more than 38,000 active BLET members and over 100,000 IBT Rail Conference members, I want to express my appreciation for the opportunity to provide this committee with our position on Senate File 2797. The BLET and the Teamsters helped create the funding and the training program that was located in Silver Springs, Maryland. That program continues through the Rail Workers Hazardous Materials Program with the HAZMAT Chemical Emergency Response Training in Houston, Texas. With the assistance of the BLET and the Teamsters, we will continue working with the International Association of Firefighters to continue the work of our unions to provide what the carriers have failed in providing. Our two organizations have recently been awarded a grant to continue this work, but this work and training gets only to a small percentage of rail workers. Hazardous material training at the awareness level that actually provides the tools our members need to protect the public, the first responders responding to an incident, our members, and the environment. We have given the FRA and the carriers our training needs through the RSAC, that Railroad Safety Advisory Committee process. We are still waiting for a response. We need field situation exercises held jointly with all the departments that would be called upon by the train crew and carrier. This type of training, along with the classroom, is valuable, as the fire, police, and the military will attest to. The BLET and Teamsters helped create the grant funding and the training program. We would like to continue that process. We would like to work jointly with the first responders and the preparedness of this bill. With that said, we need the oil producers and shippers to step up and provide the classroom and field training. This training should be provided in conjunction with the Rail Workers Hazardous Materials Program, BLET, IBT, and the International Association of Firefighters. They need to work in conjunction with the emergency personnel to provide the equipment necessary to safely evaluate any undesired release of any hazardous material from any container at any location. Our labor stance is that there should be no difference in train placement for a loaded or residue hazardous tank car that would be placed no nearer than the sixth car from any occupied locomotive, caboose, outfit car, or other occupied rail car. While there is no federal standards that require this extra train placement, there is no federal standards that restrict this safety recommendation. We need access roads built in the yards that would accommodate first responders and their equipment and train staging locations. A case in point is the Canadian Pacific Railway Yard between Dunn Yard and CP South St. Paul over in Pig's Eye. That access road was replaced by a track that was built abutting the riverfront. If this was done legally or illegally, it was not properly evaluated or vetted with first responders personnel. We would feel that toxic inhalation hazard or poison inhalation hazard car designated key train. We feel that one car of oil in a DOT 111 Type A car should designate a key train. The rail carriers have volunteered to reduce the speed of these trains, of these oil-loaded oil trains, from 50 to 40 miles per hour in our communities. 45 is the actual speed of these loaded unit oil trains, so they would only be reducing the speed 5 miles an hour, not 10 miles an hour. At this time, neither evidence nor verification of any data has been offered that 5 or 10 miles an hour improves the safety of these loaded oil trains from derailment or catastrophic release of their contents. We would like to see the increase of the schedule for track inspections with an increase of the track inspector personnel, their daily inspections and territory covered. Step up the ranks of maintenance way track personnel in order to maintain and to properly fix any track problem track and switches. Boost geometry car inspections of the tracks to a quarterly schedule. The security and securement of the locomotive cabin controls are ongoing issues. We, the BLET and Rail Labor, are working hard developing regulations that would require the locking of the cab from the inside and outside, such as deadbolt locks with key access. This type of securement of the locomotive would allow first responder access during an emergency. We have recommended locking system of the air brake system to restrict the unauthorized release of the locomotive and train air brakes. We have concerns as to new procedures of fitting air lines at public crossings that would keep air in the train line charged on the rear of portions of trains left standing after crossing has been cut. Safety issues with this procedure have not been addressed. We will continue to work with the FRA and the industry to protect our members and the public. Our perception and that of rail labor of these and other safety-related issues differs from that of the railroads. Our vision of safety comes from the rank and file, the backbone of this nation's railroads. It comes from the highly skilled, professional, hardworking brothers and sisters working days, nights, holidays, 24/7, 365 days a year, moving this nation's people and freight. We are the first responders to accidents and derailments. We are uniquely positioned to provide good judgment and ideas regarding the types of changes and recommendations that would make our industry safer and more secure. The Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen will continue to seek opportunities to work with this committee, the carriers, and federal agencies on legislative, regulatory priorities that strengthen the safety of moving America's passengers and freight as a normal course of our activity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Roth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aaron Roth. I am the executive director of the Wisconsin-Minnesota Petroleum Council. I'm a part of the American Petroleum Institute in Washington, D.C. API has 600 members worldwide involved in all aspects of the oil and natural gas industry, including pipelines. Nobody takes pipeline safety more serious than our industry. Every day, a river of crude oil and finished product flows through the United States on thousands of miles of pipelines that most people don't even know exist beneath their feet. 99.99% of that product arrives at its destination on time and in a safe manner. Our concern, as we've expressed with Senator Jensen, is that these bills kind of came up quite rapidly and now are moving, and maybe we need to take a step back and actually assess what our industry is doing in Minnesota in preparedness, what equipment is available. I'm not speaking for the rail, but we've had discussions on this very question. Is there the opportunity that rail pipelines share some of this equipment where it might be deployed in one industry and not in the other? Mr. Brown spoke about training. We've had discussions about working with labor and industry on maybe expanding training programs. The operating engineers have a facility in Hinckley that's virtually in the wintertime empty. They do train our people in the summertime, working with companies like Enbridge and others. So I think there's some opportunities here if we just kind of take a step back and relook at things. There's duplication in this bill, as I understand, and I have a couple expert testifiers behind me with our industry. Because of federal law, we're already doing some of this stuff. Some of the language is either unworkable or unattainable, from what I understand. So I hope we can work with Senator Jensen and Senator Dibble as it moves into his committee and others in the Senate to try to make this a better bill. But certainly, you know, safety and training is paramount in our industry, and we do everything we can to keep the product in the pipe, as the rail industry does, and trying to keep, you know, our product in the rail cars. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Roth. And your next witness are Mr. Lydiak and Mr.
Thank you.
Sousa.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Lydiak. I'm the pipeline director for the American Petroleum Institute. I'm happy to talk to you about our pipeline safety record and what we do for response across the country under the DOT requirements that are in place now. Pipeline operators have a goal of zero. That's the oil pipelines, which I primarily represent, the gas pipelines that are represented by others. But all the national organizations, their members have signed on to a goal of zero. And that is no spills, no injuries, no operational impacts. For our liquid lines that move crude oil and products across the country, we have an impressive record of improvement over the last 10 years or so. From 2001 to 2012, we've reduced the overall number of releases by 62% and the volumes by 47%. And those releases that were caused by corrosion were a main focus of much of the inspection and maintenance that's occurred over that time period have been reduced by as much as 80%. Every major cause category has gone down as well. This reflects better assessment technologies and practices within the industry. And while this is impressive, it's not zero yet. We're not there yet, and we clearly recognize that and strive for that goal. Job one, as Mr. Roth mentioned, is to ensure the integrity of the pipeline and to make sure that the products that we move stay within the pipeline. There are a number of requirements that we already adhere to in the DOT regulations at the federal level, which include reporting on releases and on the infrastructure, design, construction, pre-service testing, operations and maintenance, and personnel training and qualifications. And we'll mention the fact that, you know, we do inspect more than 90% of our miles of these pipelines at least once every 5 years. And when repairs are identified, they're done according to their severity. And if you have a very severe issue that you find, you repair it immediately. Part of these regulations include in operations and maintenance requirements, emergency response requirements, and operators have to put plans in place in those manuals to actually respond quickly, to identify the personnel that will be responding, what are the notifications required with local, state, and federal responders, and what are the resources that are needed to respond. And for these types of emergency incidents, it goes beyond simply oil spill response. It goes to fire or explosion that could happen or could be imminent, an accidental release, which would include oil releases, operational failures that could lead to a hazardous condition, or natural disasters that could affect pipeline operations. So those are all part of the safety requirements that are in the safety law. And then I'll mention the fact that there are also oil spill requirements under the OPA 90 requirements that require that all of our members file response plans with the federal government that require many of the same things. They say where are the response resources going to be, where they're going to be placed, and those plans are submitted to DOT for review and approval, and they have to be reviewed every 5 years. So it gives you a picture of the things that already are required at the federal level. And I know you're considering some things here at the state level to supplement that, but I think you'll see there are already many things that are already covered here. I would mention that as far as training goes, we are actually, as an industry, working very much on providing training and materials to emergency responders. We already, across the country, are providing equipment and materials like firefighting foam to fire departments. We also make them available at our facilities. We offer training. We do public outreach. And we are working on a nationwide portal that will allow emergency responders to sign in and actually learn about pipeline emergencies through that online portal. And that work is ongoing. We're working with the state fire marshals, the international fire chiefs, and the volunteer firefighters to put that portal in place and to get it up this year. So you can see we're doing a lot to try to improve how local emergency responders can respond to emergencies. These are all things that that we feel are very important because, of course, these assets are important to our members. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Goodyear.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Adam Wojciechowski. I am the team lead of emergency management for U.S. operations for Enbridge Energy. I come to you today with over 15 years in law enforcement, 15 years in EMS and rescue, and 8 years as an emergency manager. I have read the proposed bill that Senator Jensen has introduced, and I can echo my colleagues and the other testifiers' comments that Enbridge is 100% behind public safety, and we support public safety to the nth degree. There are some concerns with the bill in regards to some of the deviations from national standards under the incident command system. As it appears right now, it would create a new level called a local incident commander. And in reality, there under the national NIMS program, there is no incident commander that's a local. There's just one, and then they work under unified command. But some of these issues have been can be addressed and can be worked through. And what Mr. Roth stated is it would be the position of Enbridge that we take a step back here for a moment. Assess what has been duplicated, because a great deal of the bill has been duplicated from the 49 CFR regulations that PHMSA has jurisdiction on. See where we could have areas of improvement, and then have all the stakeholders come forth and have a more in-depth dialogue with that. Other aspects that we see can be used for areas of improvement on the bill would be the type of exercises that have been proposed. Originally, it stated a full-size exercise has to be done annually. I believe that's been amended to every 3 years. The requirements on that are very labor-intensive, not only for the responsible party, which would be the pipeline industry, but also for the stakeholders. And we do provide those opportunities for stakeholders on all of our exercises. So some of the duplication, for example, are the the exercise involvement where we have tabletops, we have equipment deployment, so on and so forth. And all of our stakeholders, local stakeholders, are engaged. We invite them to all of our exercises. We provide in-depth training. We have sponsored several local, smaller, rural fire departments that are along our corridor, which is the northern Minnesota area, to go to some industrial firefighting schools. We provide equipment to them. We provide funding for said equipment. We also provide numerous grant opportunities, which I have a handout if the clerk would like to give to the committee members in regards to the different grant opportunities that Enbridge can or does provide to the to their to our responders. The other aspect is the equipment, as has been echoed by our colleagues in the rail industry. We do have very detailed cache equipments and detailed locations where they can be found. We provide all of our local responders with what we call an emergency response and action plan. And that plan details our entire emergency response plan. And if they need specific information above and beyond that, we have each region has their own dedicated emergency response coordinator to engage with those local responders. So in conclusion, I would just like to state that Enbridge goes above and beyond what the federal regulations are. We are actively and willingly desiring to engage with Senator Jensen in this bill and make sure that public safety is ensured when we produce or when we transport the energy that we do. And I would be open for any questions if the members have any.
Thank you, Mr. Wojciechowski. Senator Rosen, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wojciechowski?
Wojciechowski.
So you are, Enbridge is the one that transports the energy from the Bakken fields, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair. Do you have different standards for states that are producing the energy, or does Enbridge have a template that they run off of, because whatever is good for Minnesota is going to be good for North Dakota or Wisconsin or wherever that pipeline is going? Can you tell me how that works? Is there other standards or protocols in place?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator. We try to keep a consistent approach to our emergency response plan. So if our employees move from one region to another region, they know how to respond. However, that's not to say that we don't have specific regional plans that address specific locations. So we do have in our response plan for this area, which is the Superior region, we have specific information that addresses the different points along the corridor in northern Minnesota and through Wisconsin into Michigan. Likewise, we do have similar specific plans that address anything in our other regions as well. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question,
Senator? Yes, it does. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I was wondering, the local incident commander that you made reference to, Senator Jensen, where did this idea come from?
Senator.
On the Section 2 subdivision.
Right. Seven. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm not aware of where it originated from, but I am aware that it is the most senior official at the site. Mm-hmm. So they have the and if they have the responsibility for controlling the operations at that site.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, I would assume you have Enbridge, who's obviously taking this very serious. I mean, this is there's no way they would want to ever compromise or put in jeopardy their business or the environment or the folks that they become that are in the path of the pipeline or the transport. And so I'm just a little I appreciate your work, Senator Jensen, on a lot of this, and the amendment does greatly improve this, but I do still and I'm listening hard to this, I still feel that we don't want to present Minnesota as an outlier and make it more difficult. I think where true success comes in when you're regulating is when you have consistency going forward. And if you're you're making Minnesota an outlier in many ways. It's very difficult for a company, no matter if you're transporting crude oil or you're transporting ethanol or producing it or whatever, you need to have consistency. And so I'm hoping that there is going to be more work on this, because there's some big concerns here that I'm just wondering if it's I wonder if just more communication needs to go forward.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I appreciate your comments on this, and that's exactly what this bill is trying to do, is provide some consistency, not so much with the individual entities that are doing and meeting the expectations at the federal level and all of those things, but for our departments within the state. And this bill provides that foundation and that base so that we know we can go in and expect certain things that each railroad and pipeline must communicate annually, and that they must do a refresher training every 3 years, and that they must do provide and submit a prevention and response plan to the MPCA. Right now, that's not currently in legislation. So we don't have consistency. We don't have what we need as a state to ensure that what's happening within the we've heard lots of testimony about what they do as individual things, but we need to make sure that we're looking at this as a state and that we know that our agencies, and there's three different departments that are involved, so that the Commissioner of Ag and the Commissioner of Pollution Control and the Commissioner of Public Safety understand exactly what that expectation is. That's what this bill is about. So I would hope that people would support this on that basis so that we can have that good foundation that sets out specific, within an hour you're going to do this. Those types of things make it consistent.
Senator Benson, then Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, I heard testimony that at the federal level these reports are being sent in every 5 years, and we're asking for three. How much work has been done to sort of align with federal standards and say, okay, if you're doing these federal things, then we'd also like you to do just a few special Minnesota things, or was this created out of whole cloth? Because right now I don't have a lot of perspective as to how much add-on work this is, how much is already sort of happening because of federal regulations, and really, if we're just taking federal rules and saying, okay, let's make sure that our agencies understand what's available, I think that makes sense. If we're adding a whole additional layer of bureaucracy, then I think we need to evaluate what the state's role is in pipeline and railroad safety and make sure that we're not being unduly burdensome. If the job's being done correctly, and we just want some comfort, that's great. If it's being done incorrectly, then we actually have a federal problem. So can you help me out? How much of this is federal duplication and how much of it is original?
To Chair and Senator Benson, I'm not aware of how much is federal and how much isn't, but maybe there's someone here that could testify and talk to that issue.
Senator Dibble on that point?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, a couple of points. One is, like I said earlier, you know, these bills were drafted with the help of the agencies, and that was a source of a lot of our conversation was, okay, so what is being taken care of federally? What are we preempted from doing? You know, where do we line up and create consistency? So the agencies may be able to answer that question with a little more precision. I don't know if anyone is here ready to answer that. There are some things that states need to be doing for themselves to make sure that they have sufficient preparedness, you know, across the spectrum of what that means for local communities to be able to respond. The only other point I was going to make, this is a response to Senator Rosen, and I think actually Senator Jensen answered the question very well. I only wanted to add to what she said is that things are changing quickly, and this is part of what these set of three bills is trying to respond to. The industry is changing, particularly the railroad industry, but also the pipeline industry, but is changing quickly, and we're seeing that happen in front of our very eyes. And part of that, of course, is, you know, I mean, so there's a lot more freight being shipped on rails for a bunch of different reasons. And there's a lot more commodities like oil from the Bakken field, and the trains are getting longer and bigger, and so things are changing, and that's manifesting itself in a variety of ways in our local communities and in our state. And even the folks from North Dakota will tell you after their disaster that just showed that where there are a lot of gaps. And then now we see federal folks engaging because they see some gaps and that we need to catch up with some of our ability to respond and some of our regulatory climate around these things. So I think what we're trying to do is create the ability to respond in a changing environment to make sure that we're keeping our communities safe in the meantime, being consistent with federal regs, even as they are starting to shift a little bit.
And Mr. Chair, I hadn't finished. I appreciate.
No, I know you're not.
I appreciate the information from Senator Dibble. I have a question about local incident commander as well, because usually in emergency response, there's a chain of command that's followed, and it's not just whoever has the most stars and bars gets to be in charge. And so I don't know that local incident commander is the right solution in an emergency response situation. I'd like to have, our Department of Homeland Security has protocols for how you respond to mass casualties. Can we model after somebody who's actually done this before? When the 35W bridge went down, I believe Fry was the police chief at the time. They executed very, very well. So we already have models in place. I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel just for pipeline response. And there are probably some things being done in industry that would be a good model as well. So I'm not sure that local incident commander is necessarily the best fit. So if we have somebody with a safety background, I'd appreciate input on that. So I guess I'd like to hear from the department on the federal conformity issue and then a local incident commander question.
Senator Jensen, while the department's coming up, did you have a comment you wanted to make?
Well, Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I understand your point about federal, state, and some of those things and matching those up. But a lot of this language in particular, including the every 3 years, is already in state law. State law requires that already. So within 115E.04. So basically we're putting this into a way and consolidating in our legislation so that the departments understand what it is and have the ability to work within those and have clarity.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Steve Lee with Pollution Control Agency. Speaking for Pollution Control Agency, some of these issues are verging into public safety sorts of concerns. With regards conformity with federal regulation, Chapter 115E, which this bill is amending, has been in place since 1991 following a very large pipeline spill in Minnesota. It was Chapter 115E originally was built to mesh with the Federal Oil Pollution Act requirements, and it has done so very well for 25 years. The pipeline companies each have a 115E plan for the past 25 years and have been updating those plans, I trust, every 3 years as they're required to. This bill provides some specificity for them to be able to plan better and for the agencies to be able to evaluate better. Perhaps also with regards to the question about incident commander, every emergency responder in the country operates under the incident command system, which says the first senior emergency responder is the incident commander. And in a town, when there's a pool of oil on the ground, the local fire chief is typically the incident commander. He may or she may bring other people in and form a unified command as they arrive, and a smart incident commander would certainly bring the company's people in to form a unified command. But until they get there, that local chief is the incident commander. and deserves the advice from the company.
Thank you. Senator Benson, did you have more?
No, thank you.
Is there other, Senator Jensen, did you have other witnesses or other points to make? Or if not, is there a discussion from the committee? This bill goes to your committee, Senator Dibble.
And I can make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 2797 as amended be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Transportation?
Yes.
Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you,
Thank
Senator
Thank you, Mr.
Jensen.
Chair, and members of the committee.
Senator Metzen's in the room. I think his is a quick bill. We have three more bills, so yes, you're in a... Yes. Welcome to the committee, Senator Jensen, Senate File 2764.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. It might be a promotion, I don't know, but hopefully this bill just repeals some, what we feel is some obsolete language, and 2754 repeals Chapter 471A related to privatization and wastewater treatment systems and water systems, and simply repeals this chapter relating to just what I said. It was enacted in 1986. My understanding was that it has never been used. And I also think the idea of private water and wastewater systems is not consistent with the sort of public policy. We have an A3 amendment that the Met Council would retain some authority, and I believe it's been worked out with everybody, and I have Mr. Jason Willett with me that would like to visit with the committee just a little bit on the amendment, and then hopefully somebody on the committee will adopt the amendment that pacifies the Met Council in this area. Did you want an explanation?
Yeah, Mr. Willett, why don't you speak briefly to it, and then we'll take up the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Jason Willett. I'm Finance and Energy Director for MCES. That's the Wastewater Division of the Metropolitan Council. If you live in the metropolitan area, we're your wastewater utility. We found this repeal bill recently, and I did look back in our records and saw that we actually have used this statute. It's in rare cases where there's something unusual about the procurement, but we did find five contracts since 2000, a little bit over $150 million, where we thought this was a good approach. It provides more flexibility for us in procurement than other statutes, and in these unusual situations, it allows us to actual access to the designers so that we can talk about innovative ideas and negotiate and easier than we can with other statutory authorities. So there's been five cases that I could find. One of them still has an existing service contract, existing 14 years of good service with the New England Fertilizer Company that's at our Shakopee plant making dried biosolid that they sell to farmers. And one last thing, Mr. Chair, we are, and the reason this came up, actually currently looking at using the statute for another unusual, innovative approach. We're trying to get some industries that provide really high-strength wastewater to us to pre-treat their wastewater, and we're looking at trying to make a program that would incentivize them to do that through this service contract mechanism. Could potentially save the metro area ratepayers tens of millions of dollars if we succeed. I'd be happy to talk about those more if you'd like.
And yeah. Senator Dibble moves the A3 amendment, which I guess is actually an author's amendment since this is the first committee.
As Mr. Chair, as Senator Metzen put it, I'd like to appease the Met Council.
We like to appease.
And I might have to vote against this amendment.
Chairman, we've got a good thing going, so Senator
Dibble moves the A3 author's amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor. Senator
Well, I do have a question about how it's crafted. So 471A.01 to 12 is repealed. But then it just says that the council may exercise its authority that had been present in 471.02 to 12.
Ms. Fontaine will comment on that.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I did find a few instances in statute that did do this way of continuing certain authority that was repealed. So it's unusual, but not in existence. So
Mr. Chair, what if just a regular person wants to go find what that means, but the language is repealed? Well, or where would they look to find that language at some point in the distant future if they don't have access to past statutes?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, in the bill itself, they're trying to do that in Section 1 and Section. They're kind of referring to Minnesota Statutes 2012. And, you know, if you have Internet access, the reviser has – you can go back and look at past statutes from 2012. So – you would be able to see what was in law at the time. So that's why we make reference to Minnesota Statutes 2012, so you could see the law as it was in existence in that
right.
year.
Thank you.
On Senator Dibble's motion on the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mr. Brian Rice is here. What's it? Visit just a little bit on behalf of AFSCME Council 5 on this issue. So,
Mr. Rice, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm here representing AFSCME Council 5 today. The bill you have before you now, as amended, is an initiative that AFSCME had looked at. And it came up in part because of Governor Dayton's unsession agenda. He had asked not only state departments, but a number of people to look at ideas to see if there's legislation that should be brought for review to the legislature to consider. AFSCME is a union of 43,000 public employees throughout the state at state and local level. This law has been on the books since 1986, and to our knowledge, I mean, prior to session, it had not been used. No water systems had been privatized. No sewage systems had been privatized. We had conversations with the PCA, other agencies, about whether this would repeal would affect anyone. We heard they wouldn't. Mr. Todd Olson is here, and I talked with Mr. Craig Johnson from the League of Cities. They're in agreement that the repeal of this law would not affect any municipal systems. But as the bill moved forward, we did learn that the Met Council had used certain selective provisions of 471A to facilitate some innovative projects, and hence we've been cooperating with them, and they brought forth the A3 amendment. We do think the privatization, particularly of municipal water systems, would be a major issue, as well as sewer systems. And given this law has been on the book for nearly 30 years and had not had any, there still is no private system in the state, Met Council has just used some provisions of the law to facilitate some projects. We're the ones bringing this forward, and we think it would make sense to repeal it. And if perhaps in the future some entity did want to privatize one of these core government functions, they ought to come back to the legislature and seek your approval on it. So we'd request your support for the legislation.
Thank you. Discussion from the committee. Anybody else who wanted to speak to the bill? If not, Senator Dibble, again,
sure.
Moves the bill.
It makes the Met Council happy.
Senator Dibble moves Senate File 2764 be, as amended, be recommended pass. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Smith. Senator Housley. And Senate File 2683 is going to be considered for inclusion in the lands bill, which is the next one on the agenda. So. Senator Housley, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I have in front of you Senate File 2683, and what this bill does, there's a four-acre parcel of property next to the Stillwater Prison, and it conveys it to the city of Bayport in order for them to build a fire station. With me, I have the mayor, Susan St. Orrs, who's here for questions, but we'll keep our testimony short. And also we have the Minnesota Department of Corrections Commissioner Tom Roy and City Councilman Patrick McGann had to leave, but we have City Administrator Logan Martin, and he'll go first.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Logan Martin, City Administrator for the City of Bayport. Very happy to be in front of you today. As the Senator mentioned, we'll keep our comments very brief. Long story short, we have a four-acre parcel of land on the Stillwater Prison property in the city of Bayport that the Bayport Fire Department has a desire to construct a fire station on. The Bayport Fire Department serves the communities of Oak Park Heights, Baytown Township, the city of Bayport, and West Lakeland Township, so about 13,000 residents across 27 square miles in Washington County. It's a growing area. It's a growing region. And as such, the fire department is growing as well. The fire department protects the Anderson Corporation, the A.S. King plant, the new St. Croix Crossing Bridge, both of the maximum security prisons, a number of schools, et cetera. So it is a high-value area, and it's a high-value department. And the department is needing to grow, and it's currently outgrown its current station. So as such, we've selected this parcel as an opportunity for the city to construct a new 20,000 square foot fire station on. As the committee is aware, this piece of land has been declared surplus by the Department of Corrections. The department no longer needs to utilize the land for the prison property. As such, it was offered to state agencies for a four-week period, whereby state agencies can acquire the land at no cost. That period has come and gone. No state agencies indicated an interest in the piece of property, so it is now being offered to the city, the county, and the school districts for the appraised market value. The appraisal performed by the Department of Administration established the land value at $200,000. This piece of land would convey the parcel to the city of Bayport at no cost. We see this as a great opportunity for a partnership, continued partnership between the Department of Corrections and the city. As you know, the Stillwater Prison is celebrating its 100-year anniversary this spring. The Bayport Fire Department has been providing fire service in the district for 125 years, so we provided fire service for the entire life of the Stillwater Prison. So this is a great way to continue that partnership, to build our prison, our station even closer to the prison, and this actually centers the station centrally in the district. So members in Senator Housley's district, et cetera, will actually see a reduction in their ISO rating, which would see a reduction in their annual homeowners insurance bills as well, because this is as close to centrally located as we could possibly be. So I think that is the extent of my testimony, and I would stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Comments from the mayor or commissioner, either of you have things you want to add.
Thank you, Chairman and committee, for your time today. We really appreciate your consideration. As Logan mentioned, this fire station is in great need. Our current facility is no longer suitable to house the equipment, and it's in disrepair. So it's also located right next to Anderson Elementary and requires backing in a vehicle. So it's a very unsafe location. So we have the full support of not only our own council, but that of the four communities that we are partnering with, along with our friends at the Department of Corrections and the Washington County. And it will provide a more central location for response times to the businesses and residences and the prison facilities. It will also lower the insurance costs for residents and businesses because of its more central location. And we just, you know, would really appreciate your support in this transfer. And the land would always remain in the public domain. We would never have the opportunity to sell it for a private purpose. If it ever weren't a fire station, it would revert back to the state. So I just think that's very important that you know that we would not profit outside of this contract. So thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mayor. And Commissioner Roy, did you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Some things in government are easy,
Hallelujah. And this is certainly one of them. Our governor has consistently told commissioners, make this government work for the people. And this is a perfect project that makes government work for the people. This is a win-win. If I, in my wildest dreams, believed that a fire department would be built on the grounds of Stillwater State Prison, I would have woken up with a big smile on my face. This is indeed an opportunity that we can't pass up. Not only the Stillwater State Prison, but we also have Oak Park Heights nearby. The facility at Stillwater has a large manufacturing plant. We regularly have emergency medical needs in both facilities, and the chief and the volunteers in the Bayport department have been excellent responders, and I can't imagine a better scenario in government than this. So I would encourage you folks to support this fully. I think the state can live without $200,000. And I hesitate to say this, but the Department of Corrections maybe would have paid that much to have a fire department located on our grounds. But I really encourage this committee to support this. And the folks in Bayport have been excellent to work with in Stillwater and Washington County. And that's all I need to say, I think.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Sarah Housley, it sounds like you got everybody on the same page on this one. Jeez.
Mr. Chair, yes, I do.
All cheerleading for it even. So. We are going to lay this over because I think it's going to be put into the Senator Herr's lands bill. Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's really nice to see it where all of you folks are cheering for the same project and seeing how it benefits everyone. Senator Rosenstein.
Oh, I was going to move it to be amended into the lands bill.
So we will lay this over, and then Senator Rosen will make that motion when we'll take up Senator Herr's bill. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you.
Senator Herr, Senate File 2449, the state lands bill. We put that amendment on before we go through the rest of the bill. So,
okay.
Senator Rosen moved that we take the contents of Senate File 20. What? Oh, we've got an amendment for it. It's the A what? A3. Senator Rosen will move the A3 amendment, which is the same wording as the bill.
I told you to do it.
That's fine. You can live with it that way. Senator, on that motion, Senator Herr, you have no problem with this, I assume, from what
I have. I have no problem. Actually, I'm quite familiar with the area myself.
Yes. Oh, yes, we have to adopt the subcommittee report. Senator Herr moves the subcommittee report, which is in front of us, is SS-2449-sub. Any discussion of that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Now Senator Rosen moves the A3 amendment to that subcommittee report. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Herr,
thank you.
Go ahead and present the bill, and you have another amendment, too, yes. Because of some
things, yes, I do.
Controversy.
Yes, I do. And first and foremost, I'd like to thank my fellow members in our land subcommittee, Senator Weber, Senator Cohen, and Senator Scazzi, and for listening to all the bills and amendments combined to this section in this 2014 Omnibus Land Bill, Senate File 2449. There were a total of 9 bills from 7 authors. Now will be 8 authors and 10 bills, and including a provision of this bill relating to tax forfeited land sale, exchange, and conveyance. The Senate File 2449 is now before you. Ms. Kathy Lewis from DNR is also here if it requires detailed explanation. However, since our recommendation to pass the land subcommittee, a couple of concerns were brought up. And the first concern is on the part of removing DNR from its role of approving tax-forfeited lands and other provision. And the second session is on Section 14, on the sale of surplus state land within state park in the Kitten County. I'd like to resolve the first concern by making an oral amendment
Actually, I think
we did that already.
Your oral
right?
amendment was put into A4 amendment, I believe. It's just one. It's the one that would delete sections 3, 4, 5, 6, and 8.
That's correct.
Okay, Senator Herr moves the A4 amendment, and that was the one. Those are the provisions where it would be removing the DNR's oversight of this. Okay. Is there any discussion of that amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And the other one, you said?
The other one is on the original section 14. We approved this section and heard no concern till today. Ms. Sarah Pake from Park and Trail Council of Minnesota.
It's yep. now,
and she'd like to testify and ask that the lot remain as state park land.
And, so. And I believe that's what's now section 27 of this of the subcommittee report. I believe on page 16 is that the one you're referring to? The Kitson that's County.
Correct. The let's see.
Lake Bronson State Park.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and speak to the concerns.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Sarah Pasek. I am a legislative consultant from the McGranchey Law Firm, and we represent the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota. The Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that exists to acquire, protect, and enhance critical land for the public's use and benefit. As a distinguished partner in the development of our state's outdoor recreation system for the past 60 years, our place in the Minnesota's Parks and Trail legacy is established. We were instrumental in the creation of Afton and Grand Portage State Parks and the expansion of Wild River State Park. We just want to express our concern about the provisions contained in the section that you had talked about relating to the selling of 2.15 acres of state-owned land within Lake Bronson State Park. The language of the bill says that the land is not needed for natural resource purposes, yet the land is clearly within Lake Bronson State Park. We believe that state law states that state-owned lands designated as state parks are perpetually dedicated and that a state agency shall not sell state park land. We've been having conversations with the DNR about this, but at this point we still have concerns about the selling of that land, which is located right in the middle of a state park. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring that to your attention today.
So, Mr. Chair, yes.
Go ahead, Senator.
I also like to ask DNR Ms. Kathy Lewis to.
Ms. Lewis, welcome to the committee.
From her side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy Lewis, Lands and Minerals, DNR. This Kitson County parcel proposal came from an extensive discussion we've been having with Kitson County on strategic land asset management and looking at the role of DNR in the county. So it's been it's an outcome of that effort to look at how we manage the lands and the county manages its tax forfeited lands. These parcels are in a subdivision that was platted within an area that's within Lake Bronson State Park. These parcels are intermingled with privately owned parcels. So there's some cabins adjacent to the parcels, and we are not proposing to sell all the platted parcels. We're proposing to sell along an area of a strip within the subdivision that's intermingled with other parcels. And so it's an outcome and an outreach that we've made to the county, and that's why we have brought this forward.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I tend to agree with Ms. Pisick. This was discussed quite extensively at our Lands Committee, and it just didn't seem quite right to be selling state land totally within a state park. So I appreciate that you've brought this issue forward, and I thank you for that. I'm not sure what the outcome would be, and then maybe we'll get some more insight with this, but it just didn't seem right to me. Thank you.
And And Ms. Pisick, you were, one of your concerns was that because this is supposed to be in perpetuity, that your concern is the precedent, or?
Right. We're not aware of any other times where, or Mr. Chair and members, we're not aware of other times where the DNR has sold state park land that's, you know, not on the edge of a park or as part of a boundary adjustment for a state park or an easement, or typically those are the times when state park land might be sold for one reason or another, but this is kind of right in the middle of the state park.
Senator Hurd, did you want to take it out, keep it in? What's your sense of?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have this omnibus bill go smoothly with no controversy and on the floor. And so I'd like to have more time for discussion. Perhaps next year we could bring this forward. And so I would like to, delete that section.
Is there further discussion from the committee? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just give comment that I think that the location of the proposed lots to be sold within a separate subdivision sort of creates a unique situation as opposed to within the middle of the park. And that type of a location greatly inhibits, I think, the further development of that into maybe a full-fledged park usage. And I totally understand where the department is in their analysis of this. And I just wish to get that on the record, because I think their recommendation was correct. And if the chair's decision, Senator Herr, wishes to defer, I'll not argue with him on that. But I think that the right decision was made concerning that.
And maybe I mean, Senator Scalzi's apparently been to Lake Bronson before.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just interesting to see some controversy on the Lands Committee, and I appreciate that we can disagree. It doesn't have to be everyone in agreement, and yes, I have been there, and thank you for that.
There, however, were no minimum limit sizes that we were, or sizes that we were arguing in that. So,
are you thinking Muskie? Senator Herr moves to delete Section 27 and think it over in the next year. Any discussion? Further discussion? If not, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
Well, first, we he's
on
got
that.
His
I'm
front.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Oral amendment to delete Section 27. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies. I do have the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, is the A2 amendment or A1?
Well, it says A1, but it's the Root River Regional Park.
I've got it as an A2.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment.
A1 and a half?
Sort of. It's coming. Thank you.
Get one to Senator. That's good. Senator Rosen, why don't you speak to it while it's being distributed?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It basically is a situation down in Olmsted County where they would like to expand the Root River Regional Park. And so they mapped out this area that includes, I believe, 100 or about 60 homes. And it's because of that mapping out, I think there's been no more development, and they can't really improve on the area. Basically, this amendment says that before they can expand the park, they need to make sure that it has been approved by the township board, and then the board needs to give an approval up or down within 60 days of receiving the proposal. This came from Senator Nelson, of course, down in Olmsted County, and I think she would welcome a discussion on this, and I will then defer to the author of his bill to see whether he accepts it or not. But I do think it's a worthy discussion.
Senator Scalzi, and then is DNR ready to speak to this in a second? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Subcommittee on Lands is a bill referring to state lands, and this doesn't – is there state lands in here, Senator Rosen? I'm just not sure if this fits within this bill.
Senator Rosen, I think she's asked. I think Senator Nelson mentioned it to me. She wanted it to be discussed for a few minutes, and so maybe DNR, I don't know if DNR has a position on it because it's basically a county issue, it seems.
Right.
But yeah. No comment?
Comment from DNR.
Okay. I think Senator Scalzi, right, it probably doesn't belong in this bill, but I think she expressed concern she wanted the county board to be taking another look at this, I guess. Is that Senator Rosen?
Yes, that's right. I was just going to ask her to.
Okay. And I assume nobody from Olmsted County is here today, but I think that she can. Anyway, go ahead, Senator Rosen.
No one's here, Mr. Chair. And I guess it does seem reasonable to me that there should be, a checklist. Oh, there's Senator Nelson. If she could, I did present your.
Maybe you want to speak to your amendment briefly. I think there was discussion whether a county lands bill should be in the state lands bill, but just to talk about the idea for a minute. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, for offering this amendment. This amendment has to do with the Root River Regional Park in Olmsted County. There was the county had proposed to map future expansion of the Root River Regional Park. It was a significant expansion, hundreds of acres, and it involved a number of homeowners whose land was going to be in this new map, which basically said, well, the county at some point wants to buy your land to become part of this park, but we're not ready to buy it now. We're not going to make any offers now. But in the meantime, because you're in this map, this mapped area of the land we'd like, you cannot improve your property. And to me, that was really, I thought that was wrong in the first place, to infringe upon property owners' rights because you might want the land in the future. And then also the fact that it seems to me that we should be talking to the township officers. In this case, all the township officers voted against this mapping. And so my amendment here is an attempt to retain local control and to make sure that we protect property rights for landowners when there's some use or some better use that some think might happen at some point in the future. And so I would just as soon have the county say, we would like your land and here's our offer to buy it. But they're not willing to do that now. They want instead to have this map, which would actually hold down the property values. So, Mr. Chair, that's the intent of this amendment, to bring this to discussion.
Okay. Mr. Knopf, I was just curious, I mean, if a county makes an official map of a plan for a park, that has a binding authority on land, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, my understanding in Chapter 394 of the local planning that sometimes an official map can be an official control.
Okay, so it's not a traditional use of the term mapping. It's more of a zoning type of thing.
It is for zoning. Yes.
And, Mr. Chair, that was my concern exactly.
So, Mr. Chair, I think Senator Scalzi has a point. Where would you adjust something like this? What could you do if it was not
I think it's kind of state and local,
more of
state and local fight, I think. I don't serve on that committee, but I think some of you do. But yeah.
Mr. Chair, the bill does. The title is a bill relating to state lands. Although I'm thinking we need to change the title because in subcommittee, there was the Brainerd Dam was included in this, which isn't state lands. Now we may need to change that title to relating to natural resources. So I think the bill will be relating to natural resources, but
okay,
in the next round.
Senator Nelson, my suggestion would be that you put this together in a bill related to this because I understand the concern of the folks about. I did not realize mapping of a park by a county board has the same authority as sort of it has an impact of zoning, but I'm not
sure. So, Mr. Chair,
I will withdraw my amendment, and I'll take your advice. I basically wanted to make sure that we had – oh, I guess I can't withdraw. I'm not on your committee. My mistake. I turn it over to Senator Rosen.
I'd like to ask that Senator Rosen withdraw.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if I could just mention, I do thank you for the opportunity to bring this forward for discussion. I do think it really merits further discussion and looking at how we can protect landowners from this type of mapping that maybe wasn't intended for parks but being applied to the park setting. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, because I think some of us learned something from this.
So thank you, Senator Rosen.
With that, Senator Hurd, did you have any other things you wanted to point out in the bill? Or?
Mr. Chair, that's pretty much it, and I would like to see. Give me the language here.
Move the Senate file.
Amend it.
Oh, actually, you know, Senator Bond.
To the floor, won't it?
I didn't get anything.
It'll go to the floor, won't it?
I think it was the floor, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Senator Hurd moves that Senate file 2449 as amended be recommended to pass and recommended to pass. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And thank you to Senator Hurd and the Land Subcommittee for putting together the stuff, because, as Senator Scales, you pointed out, it's not always the most...
Very controversial.
Thank you.
Senator Hurd, who was on the committee? Senator
Weber,
Scalzi,
Coonan, and Senator Weber.
Okay. Thank you to all of you for putting together the bill. And with that, this committee is adjourned. We'll see you on Thursday.